This is Current State. Thanks for listening today. I did not know until yesterday that a violin played on the Titanic the night it sank had survived the catastrophe. And not just any violin. It's the one played by bandleader Wallace Hartley, who perished in the disaster 101 years ago. According to the Associated Press, the violin with Hartley's name on it is believed to have been found at sea with the musician's body more than a week after the Titanic sank. The instrument itself is corroded and unplayable, according to the AP, but it also reportedly has been vetted by all kinds of qualified people who say, yeah, this is Wallace Hartley's violin. Despite being corroded and unplayable, it nonetheless sold at auction on Saturday for, I want to milk this Antiques Roadshow moment, $1.6 million. And some people who follow Titanic memorabilia say that will never be equaled. Coming up on the program later today, Buckminster Fuller, the visionary architect, also designed a car. You may not be aware of that. It was called the Dymaxion. We talk with a filmmaker coming up who has made a film all about Buckminster Fuller's car. It held 12 people. We will talk with him, and there's lots more coming up here on Current State. Our election 2013 coverage continues today with two of the candidates for at-large seats on the Lansing City Council. There are four candidates for the two seats. Last week we spoke with incumbent Brian Jeffries and challenger Judy Brown Clark. Today we're joined by the other incumbent seeking re-election, Kathy Dunbar. Kathy, welcome back to Current State.
Awesome to be here.
And challenger Ted O'Dell. Ted,
good morning.
Kathy.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Good morning. Glad to have you here, Ted. Kathy is director of the South Lansing Community Development Association, a nonprofit organization she founded to improve economic opportunities and quality of life on Lansing's South Side. Ted O'Dell formerly was the city manager in Beaverton, Michigan, and founded the Lansing Jobs Coalition, supporting the building of a Native American casino in Lansing. Our first question here, Kathy, if you're reelected, what single challenge facing the city would you most like to help solve?
I'm very interested in budget, and I know that that's going to be at the top of almost everybody's priority list. But the last year when we went through the budget process, I was really excited to do some grassroots engagement throughout the community, educating people about how municipal budgeting works and where the funding comes from, what happens to services when funding is lowered. Because we always ask people, what do you want to keep? There's never an advocate for cutting anything. There's an advocate for everything. And so when it comes time to make really tough decisions about what we can do with limited resources, I want people to understand that money really doesn't grow on the tree in Lansing. The tree is the taxpayer. And so, I really like people to understand the basics of the budget. And given that this is probably going to be the first year that we're coming out of this recession and having limited resources, the property values are going up. We may get more state revenue sharing. We may actually have a zero-sum game this year. I don't want people to think that it means we have a license to spend because we have so much long-term legacy costs that we have to start funding. And I really want to make sure that we consider having a more conservative outlook on that funding for at least a short period of time.
Ted, if you're elected, what single challenge facing Lansing would you most like to help solve?
I'd certainly like to dive into the fiscal responsibility of the city. As Kathy mentioned, the budget has been tight. The economy is turning around. But one of the things that I think we could look at here on a local basis is a follow-up. We need quality follow-up on tax abatements that are given to corporations that promise jobs and money to our community. And I believe that if we do follow up with those corporations and there is errors found, or if we discover that they have not held up their end of the bargain, there should be real penalties to those companies here within the city, specifically those companies that have sought out tax abatements here in the community.
You're not convinced that that is happening, but you say it needs to be looked into?
That is correct.
Okay. WKAR has been speaking with Lansing residents who have weighed in with questions and comments for the candidates. Here is one of them.
David Lambert, Potter Walsh neighborhood. So what would you do in office to make sure that a casino is not built in the city of Lansing?
Wow.
Ted, you are known for your effort 2 years ago to get a casino proposal before the city council or on a ballot proposal. But how do you respond to residents who dislike or even strongly dislike the idea of a casino?
Those folks that I ran into as I go door to door who are concerned about a potential casino in Lansing, once I take a few minutes to explain to them how it would benefit our community on so many different levels, and this is one issue that Kathy and I agree upon, is that not only would it help the economy of the city, it will help our convention business, our hotel business, as well as bring money into our public schools. And aside from that, it will also provide quality, good-paying jobs that have good benefits as well. A casino would add more activity downtown, more entertainment downtown. I've said for quite a long time now that Lansing needs more than just bars and baseball downtown. And I think an entertainment venue that has legal casino gaming is a positive thing. And for anyone that thinks there isn't already gaming going on in our community, I would say simply just look around. Go into some of the bars and taverns around town. There's a big poker room over in East Lansing. There are bingo parlors all over town. So if we could capture some of those monies and keep that money here in our community instead of busing people, literally busing people to other communities such as the Firekeepers Casino or the casino in Mount Pleasant, I just think it would be a really nice addition to downtown. And my feeling is we are the capital city. We should be the best city in the state.
Kathy, anything?
Be a step in the right direction.
Kathy, are you on the same page basically on that one? Is there much to add?
There's a little bit to add. We definitely do bus folks out of town. Their Dean Transportation has busing. We take about 800 people a week, I believe, is the number. Not sure how that is seasonally, but there's quite a few people a week that leave and go to Mount Pleasant or go to Firekeepers. One of the other interesting things that I really like about the proposal is that when people talk about what they're concerned about with the casinos, a lot of times they'll think of Detroit and the crime issue, and the way that was negotiated is there's an increase in funding to public safety from the tribe as from the profits of the casino to actually mitigate any potential, although we haven't seen it in places like Firekeepers where there wasn't an increase in issues. And actually Battle Creek, and interestingly enough, they put Firekeepers out in the township, and now they're kind of regretting it because the amount of money that's coming into the township is not benefiting the downtown area there. Plus the education fund. Having something like the Kalamazoo Promise here in Lansing to sort of solidify the family base and keep the kids in school so that they can achieve a scholarship fund at the end of their career here in the Lansing schools is a cool thing.
Well, when candidates agree on things, it makes those of us in the media very nervous. So let's move on to another
question.
Yeah, you
want to have the fireworks
here.
Going. Right. Come on.
Ted O'Dell, you've been a labor negotiator and an advocate of organized labor and union jobs. Earlier this year, Mayor Brunero's financial health team recommended cuts of $1 million to the Lansing police budget and $2 million to the fire budget. Is there fat in these contracts as that would suggest, or have the union leaders been correct when they've said they've given all they should give?
I believe they've given all they could give at this point. I'm having been born and raised in a UAW household and having been a professional labor negotiator myself, I'm an advocate of, it goes back to education. Folks need to realize, including the mayor, that these contracts that are in place currently with our city employees, these are covenants that were bargained and negotiated at a table by both sides, administrators, and not specifically this mayor, but previous administrations. And union leaders. And I believe we as a community need to honor those covenants. And are there problems in funding as far as pensions? Sure there are. But we're not the only ones in that boat. And I think we need to make changes going forward. But I would certainly hate to see the city renege on any commitments that we've already made in the past in good faith.
Kathy, what about the sacred covenants idea here that Ted's putting on the table?
Well, I think that in city government, one of the things that I learned very quickly, it's not the same necessarily as your home budget. The covenants that we make are, nobody anticipated that we would have a downturn in the economy, where property values would drop and where tax revenues would go down. Nobody anticipated state shared revenue would go down. And I think that you have to be fluid enough in your thinking to deal with those or you end up in a situation like Pontiac or Detroit. I mean, bankruptcies are caused by long-term legacy costs that have been unfunded because people aren't willing to make those choices. And, you know, I respect the covenants that have been made by labor so far, but there are certain labor organizations that have come to the table with a much more amenable attitude about negotiating. It's a far different thing to give up a portion of your wages than to give up overtime. You know, we've had people in the city where their parks department and the public service department, they were cut in their hours they went to 36-hour work weeks. They had equipment costs, a lot of things through the furlough time. We held police and fire harmless as long as we could. So, you know, minimum staffing, fire came to the table and they adjusted their minimum staffing levels and they negotiated on health care. Police were not willing to do that. And it doesn't mean that anybody on either side, I think as a labor negotiator, you have to understand both sides of the argument. You can't just come in advocating on behalf of union members and without understanding the fiscal responsibilities in the city.
What about that, Ted? I mean, can sacred covenants stay sacred indefinitely into the future?
It sounds
like you think they should, but the circumstances have been brutal.
Correct. I think those covenants that are in place need to stay in place, and we need to make changes going forward. Kathy brought up two very good points I'd just like to mention briefly. State shared revenue. A lot of your listeners will realize that the state legislature has done a great injustice, not only to the city of Lansing, but other municipalities around the state, in withholding state shared revenue. They are holding what rightfully belongs to the citizens of Lansing. And I would like to see the mayor use some of his talents and skills to go after the state legislature and the governor, demanding that we get our money. And then Kathy had briefly mentioned, and maybe she could talk a little bit more about this, you remember just a year or so ago, the citizens of Lansing voted to tax ourselves to fund police and fire at the level it's currently funded. So I think it's important that we honor that and honor the wishes of the voters as well.
I would be glad to expand on that. Until the state legislature and the governor change their mind, we have to work within the budgets that we have. We can't be, you know, in la-la land thinking that we can budget according to what potentially might change in the future. We've got to deal with the budget. We under the Municipal Uniform Budgeting Act, we're not like the federal government where if the budget doesn't balance, we can just go ahead and write a check and have a credit card that's, you know, payable by China. We actually have to, by law, have a balanced budget every year, and we have to work within the parameters of that year. And yes, I'm so appreciative of the fact that the voters did put that through. One of the other incumbents was very adamantly against putting that even on the ballot. Mr. Jeffries did not want to even put it on the ballot for folks to consider at the time. And I was, myself and Councilmember Yorko and several others, we actually worked the phones and we went door to door to try to help people understand that there were going to be ramifications in police and fire if we did not increase our revenue source. And we have since brought back the positions that were eliminated when we didn't have the funding, because we did finally have to have layoffs in that department. And so I'm very happy of the work that we did on the millage.
We're talking with Kathy Dunbar, incumbent at large council member on the Lansing City Council, and challenger Ted O'Dell. They are two of four people running for two seats on the council on November 5th. As at large candidates, you both would represent the entire city. I'd like to get your response to a comment by Catherine Mooney, who serves as president of the Northtown Neighborhood Association. This involves city services.
We're pretty used to not having support in city services over there. So for us, these new fiscal concerns are just one more realization that neighbors have to come together to do what neighbors need to do for each other.
I detect kind of a go-it-alone kind of attitude there.
Well, the good news is with 1,500 homes, you don't feel very alone.
She sounds frustrated with the level or the quality of services she's getting from City Hall. Is there a delivery problem, Kathy, getting services to Lansing residents? Or
I would say that the frustration she feels, I know Catherine pretty well, and I know the frustration she feels is felt in a lot of different neighborhoods. When the budget went down, and I've been on the council for 8 years, seven of those have been in a deficit budget scenario. So we've been reducing how we, you know, what we can provide while keeping what is important to voters, which is the core services of police, fire, and roads. I love her in that she has this ability to organize up there. That's what I do in my day job. We organize folks to take care of what needs to be taken care of. We educate people that, yeah, maybe the parks aren't going to be mowed every week, but there are things that neighbors can come together to do to take care of with Neighborhood Watch, with beautification efforts. And there isn't any one particular part of the city that's receiving anything different than everybody else. The neighborhoods across the board have been learning that it's hard when you have to tighten your belt that things have to get cut.
Ted O'Dell, are there things that can be done to better get services to neighborhoods in Lansing?
I think Catherine brings up a good point. She's been a friend for several years, as Kathy said, you know, the public has been polled, and the core services that people are requesting are police, fire, and roads. Along with that, I would throw in the little caveat that Lansing still has dirt streets within the city, which I think is atrocious. But back to Catherine's point, there's a number of things communities can do, especially with all of our neighborhood groups, as far as Neighborhood Watch and beautification committees and things of that nature. Unfortunately, because the city budget is so tight right now, we don't have a lot of money to be able to supply all the needs of people want at this point. So it's a question of, you know, what's a priority? What do you want in your neighborhood? And in my book, police and fire are a number one. I think we need to protect those services and increase those wherever possible. I'm an advocate of bringing the police officers back downtown, for starters. I think that would be a positive step forward. And then I also believe in community policing and putting the firefighters back into the neighborhoods they belong.
Ted, as a candidate who supports labor, what do you make of UAW Region 1C's endorsement of Kathy? Did you anticipate getting that endorsement?
I anticipated having a fair shake at the endorsement, which all the candidates were interviewed by a large committee of members. The UAW had chosen to stick with the mayor and the candidates he is supporting. With that said, the mayor has had a long history with the UAW, but what is a head-scratcher for many of us is that given the record of many of the council members and the mayor constantly voting against labor here in the city as to why they would go ahead and endorse her candidacy again. But I'm still a fervent believer in organized labor, born and raised that way, worked for labor, a teamster myself. I'm not, you know, disheartened by that. However, I do understand there's politics being played at a much higher level than that of city council, and we'll just write it out and see where we end up on election day.
Kathy, you did not get the Fraternal Order of Police endorsement, which is probably one you would have preferred to get. I totally understand that, though.
You know, it's interesting for Ted to bring up the politics of it and the fair shake. I did not even get an interview with the Fraternal Order of Police. They made up their mind that they were going to endorse a new person beforehand. So when you want to talk about politics, that's an interesting concept when you consider who's probably going to be there and have to work with them. But the funny thing is, I think that there's a disconnect between the FOP and their membership, and it's all about the way that labor contracts are negotiated. I work with a lot of folks. I ride on the trucks. I am very close with a lot of folks in the Parks Department. I understand the needs a lot of those folks have, and I am proud to have the UAW endorsement. On the police side of things, I'm also friends with a lot of officers on the street, and the younger officers. It was a crying shame that the year that we ended up laying off officers because there wasn't any funding, the firefighters came to the table and negotiated, and police didn't, and we held off. That's the budget that people will talk about in 2011, where there was $2 million sort of on the table for police to come to the table and come up with some cost savings. And I think it's a testament that they weren't dictated how they were going to cut, that we were asking them to come up with these savings. And there was health care that we could have negotiated. There was staffing levels we could have negotiated. And then when I say staffing, I mean just reorganizing, not laying people off. And the firefighter membership told their leadership, save as many jobs as possible. And they did. They came to the table and negotiated. In police, we ended up laying off 36 officers. And people didn't even want to negotiate they gave up overtime. It's a cush, and you have to start to wonder at what point does the higher level seniority actually represent the officers. We awarded people for saving people from burning buildings and for saving lives, and 2 weeks later we had to lay them off because they were the youngest seniority members on the police department. It was a crying shame.
Ted, we'll give you a minute to respond to that.
sure. That's the way, you know, union negotiations work. You know, those are contracts are bargained in good faith by both sides, be the administration or the union leadership. And, you know, times change with budgets and other items going on around the area. But, you know, that's the nature of the business, so to speak. And the younger members realize that they may have a potential layoff, whether we're talking UAW, firefighters, police, or school teachers.
But sacred covenants can't always stay sacred, is what that suggests.
Well, yeah, true. But my feeling is, Mark, is that those contracts that have already been put in place must be honored as far as pensions and benefits and health care. If we're going to make changes, we need to make changes as we go forward.
Even know how to respond to that. I'm like dumbfounded because those young officers signed a contract to work with us and they paid union dues to have someone negotiate on their behalf for their benefit, and they got sacked.
Okay, let's move.
And that's the nature of the union business. That's the way it works.
Then that's the nature of the city budget, too. So.
All right, we'll leave it at that. Every candidate we've spoken to so far, you two included, insist their independent voices with regard to the mayor's agenda. Sometimes you agree, sometimes you don't. Nonetheless, Kathy, you've sided with the mayor, I guess, often enough that you are viewed as an ally. And Ted, you have not received Virge Bernero's endorsement. Can you talk to us, Kathy Dunbar, about this perception of the blocks on the council, factions on the council?
Yeah, I'd love to. I always enjoy listening to people say that it's just perception, that it's not reality, because it's reality. I've been there for 8 years, and I don't BS about this. I'm raising 4 kids, and there was a time when I left the house thinking that I was going to go talk to big people. You know, I'm going to work to talk to big people, and I left the kids at home. And there are times when I go to council and I think my kids are more mature than some of the folks that I work with up there. That being said, there's a perception because it happens, and the issue that I always find interesting is those who claim that I am in the side with the mayor will also, when asked why they are considered obstructionists, say, but we side with the mayor 97% of the time. So you can't have it both ways. You can't bash me for supporting his agenda on one hand and then say that on the other hand, you're with him 97% of the time. The issue is always the 3%. It's the issues on which we differ and how severely we differ. I agree that with the mayor that when the economy is downturned, we should be doing everything that we can to search for grants and funding that's coming, that's designated for us, that we've been requested, like when the DNR requested that we do a proposal for a pathway along the Moores River Drive to make it safer for folks because it was unsafe to walk and they wanted some river improvements there. When somebody's offering you free money, you go for it. You don't vote it down. And I think that those are the things that really make us make it different. And I don't agree with the mayor on everything. We disagreed on his dog ordinance. He didn't want to buy a park. I ended up writing a grant for $750,000 to preserve 28 acres of riverfront property. He didn't want another park in the system. I negotiated it so that we didn't have to pay a dime for it and we don't have to maintain anything on it.
Ted, if Kathy's right and if you're elected, would you expect to become a member of the Wood Jeffries Coalition on the council?
I would expect to work with everyone on the council, including the administration. I have a long history with the mayor. He and I worked together as staff members in the legislature years ago, and he's always been a strong personality. And I mean, that really shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. But with that said, he has had some good ideas, and he's had some not so good ideas. But I think what the taxpayers expect of their council members and the mayor are to work as adults, to get along, try and bargain agreements amongst themselves that benefit the city and the community as a greater good. And, you know, I would fully expect to have a good working relationship with the mayor and the leaders of the council, whether they're, you know, whether it's Carol Wood or Brian Jeffries or someone else on the council. Several folks on the council are friends of mine. I've gotten to know Kathy a little bit through the campaign, and I have no doubt that we could all work together.
We've got another question here we want to hear from a Lansing resident. This involves regionalism.
Howard Pizzo from Delta Township. I'm interested in knowing what the candidates in Lansing are focused on in terms of regional cooperation and improvement of the region as a whole.
Kathy Dunbar, talk to us about regionalism.
I think it's a model that's working well in many other cities, and it's something that we need to expand upon. We've started with regionalizing funding for the zoo because most of the people who use the zoo were from outside of the city. I'm hoping that we can do the same with the River Trail. I love the idea that, you know, the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission is now actually becoming so relevant because funding for, not that they always haven't been, but the need for them and everybody to buy into a common project for federal funding for regional development of trails and pathways and roads and a regional vision for green space development and economic development can only benefit us, plus the cost savings if we actually combine regionalized services. So it's, we can make things more efficient and sort of cut out some of the administrative costs like we've done with the fire departments with East Lansing and Lansing. It's silly to me that the township has five non-contiguous borders that are around Lansing. They have their own fire department, and sometimes they get calls and they have to cross through the city of Lansing to get to the other side of town. And that's why, you know, having kind of mutual aid agreements and things are really important. So definitely the future.
Ted O'Dell, is there low-hanging fruit in the regionalism or service sharing discussion?
I think regionalism would be a positive step forward for the greater Lansing community. Kathy had touched on a few things, the zoo, the River Trail. I would also add to that list the airport, and as she had mentioned, the agreement we have currently with the fire department in East Lansing. And specifically, as a former township supervisor, we get asked a number of times while I was on the campaign trail about the relationship between the city of Lansing and Lansing Township. And in all honesty, there's no good financial reason Lansing Township should exist on its own any longer. As Kathy mentioned, we have multiple borders, and it's sort of awkward when they or we have to cross borders to get to, you know, our citizens that are in need of help. But the ultimate thing is, and the real thing that your listeners need to know, if there's ever any merger between Lansing Township and the city, that's a decision that will be solely made by the voters of Lansing Township per state law. I know the mayor would like to incorporate them into the city, and I think that's a good thing. But ultimately, the final say is going to come down to those voters within the township, not the administration, not the city council, and not the voters of Lansing.
Kathy, real quickly, should Lansing Township just eventually be removed from the map?
You know, it's a yes. I mean, I'm not even going to lie about it. The townships that surround major urban cores tend to be a difficult issue for anyone that's trying to do urban revitalization. It is up to the township voters, but I think what you do is present a case of what's in it for me, and we make that case. It's a shame that we subsidize a lot of the infrastructure in the township. They do have a lower tax base, so, you know, convincing them to come back to the city would be a great thing. But having a DDA, I mean, there's a downtown development authority for Lansing Township. Can you identify a downtown? You have an Eastwood Town Center that popped up that has become sort of a commercial entity in the township, but it is not a downtown.
Okay, we've got to leave it at that. Kathy Dunbar is an incumbent member of the Lansing City Council. Ted O'Dell wants to be an at-large member of the Lansing City Council, and there are two openings and four candidates. We shall see the results on November 5th. We want to thank both of you for your willingness to step up and serve in Lansing, and thanks for being with us, Kathy and Ted.
Thanks for having us.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR, Buckminster Fuller has been called the grandfather of the modern green movement. He's best known for his geodesic dome, the self-supporting soccer ball-like structure. Less well known is his work on a car called the Dymaxion. It was a three-wheeled vehicle that resembled a teardrop and could carry a dozen people. Filmmaker Noel Murphy has made a documentary called The Last Dymaxion, Buckminster Fuller's Dream Restored. He's on the MSU campus for a screening of the movie tonight at the MSU Library. Noel Murphy, welcome to Current State.
Hi, thank you.
If you know one thing about Buckminster Fuller, it's that he created the geodesic dome, this building that looks like half a soccer ball. Sustainability was one of his goals. It's less well known that he designed and built a, quote, green, unquote, car in 1933. What were the unique qualities of the Dymaxion?
Well, the Dymaxion car, remember that commercial where the guy said, hey, dude, where's my flying car? Right?
Yeah.
As though he had been promised a flying car. Well, who promised us a flying car? And it turns out it was Richard Buckminster Fuller, inventor, designer, and self-proclaimed comprehensively realizable, industrially feasible, anticipatory design scientist.
Good luck.
And where's Victor
that.
Borg when you need him to put a punctuation mark at the end
right.
of that sentence?
The Dymaxion could fly?
Well, the Dymaxion was proposed as the first flying car, and it's not so silly at this point when we take a look at what anticipatory design really is. Anticipatory designers have to gauge the future. They're not entrepreneurs in the same way as a financial risk taker. In fact, anticipatory designers are really excellent at losing money for entrepreneurs, and one of the reasons why is they're designing for materials that don't exist yet. Case in point, the Dymaxion car was supposed to be the first flying car. Well, how is that going to happen? It was going to happen with a jet stilt system. What's a jet stilt? Well, you have two jet engines that are pointing downward at the ground, allowing this thing to fly. Well, that's not so silly today when we consider that VERTOL, vertical takeoff and landing, are what aircraft are the aircraft of choice for the United States Navy on aircraft carriers. Hmm. So he saw way into the future. And in many areas, housing, he saw it in education. He saw into the future in the area of food, shelter, redistribution of world resources, but also he was the first one to ever really map those resources.
How did the Dymaxion move on the ground, though? I mean,
it was a land taxi vehicle, so it had three wheels steered in the back. The film isn't really about the car, even though there is a focus on it. It's what a lot of people know. Bucky Fuller from the car. But in order to understand the car, you have to understand what his generalized principles were, the principles that allowed a geodesic dome to work, the principles that allow synergy, which is a phrase he coined and made famous. Mm. But synergy is a end result unpredictable by the sum total of the parts, by the individual parts, I mean. So these are all physics principles, architectural principles, that he applied to the car. But in 1927, he put out a manifesto. 1927, he got extremely despondent over the loss of his four-year-old daughter to spinal meningitis and polio. And he drank so much that he became despondent and wanted to commit suicide. And he was going to jump off the cliff in Chicago at Lake Michigan. And he had a moment of clarity. And the moment of clarity was that he had never done his own thinking, that he didn't know what he really could do with an attitude of service toward humanity, and that was the one big unanswered question for him, and he couldn't kill himself until he'd answered that question, and he never answered the question.
Well, that seed must have been planted in him at some point, even though it was, as you say, obliterated by this personal, this family tragedy. Can you tell us about that? His upbringing extraordinary?
His upbringing was extraordinary. He was blind until the age of 5 years old. Now, I just did aerial photography over the island that he grew up on, and I just visited his hometown of Milton, Massachusetts. So I went up to Bear Island, Maine. I went to Milton. I've talked to a number of people that knew him. I've interviewed all of his business partners and friends, his daughter, some of his family. And when he was 5 years old, he got his first pair of glasses. And what he had, he was forced. Now, imagine being a genius who can't see. What kind of developmental, anomaly are you going to have? Mm-hmm. Well, education teaches us that math, science, geography, physics, biology, these things are all separate issues. Well, his mind saw them all as one subject. And all you needed to do is give the man some vision as a young kid and point him toward a future. And he was going to not only imagine a future that would work for 100% of humanity, he would map how to do it, and he would be more brilliant than anybody before him.
Reminded of Da Vinci.
Yeah, well, that's
Leonardo, modern Leonardo.
McClellan called Bucky Fuller the Leonardo da Vinci of our times.
Yeah. Now, were Dymaxions built? And if so, how
many? No, the Dymaxion number one rolled over, and the driver was killed. And, you know, not that this is really important, but it was a man named Francis Turner. And he's always been reported as a race car driver, but I've been in touch with Francis Turner's family. He was the first pilot to fly the Mason-Dixon line with airmail. So it was always aeronautical or nautical. It was supposed to be a submarine. It was supposed to be an airplane. It was supposed to be a utility vehicle. It was supposed to be all these things. You know, so the Dymaxion car is pretty fascinating. It was never built. There were three prototypes. Amelia Earhart ordered car number four before she disappeared. She forgot to leave a deposit.
Fuller was close friends with Amelia Earhart. We have actually a clip of him talking about their friendship and how much she supported the Dymaxion project. Let's listen.
Amelia Earhart was a very, very great friend of mine. She just really loved my car. She received the gold medal of the National Geographic in Washington, and Mrs. Roosevelt asked her to come down and stay with her at the White House. And Amelia said, Bucky, I'd like to have your car to be my official car so that your car can really be in on the celebration in Washington, which was a darling of her. But she did things like that all the time.
Yeah.
So how many other well-known influential people was he in contact with?
Well,
he
worked with H.G. Wells, Osamu Noguchi, Albert Einstein, in later years, John Lennon, Indira Gandhi.
Okay. Did he, I can't get past this notion that he was blind until he was 5 years old.
Yeah.
And you think of a five-year-old suddenly being able to see, that is extraordinary. Did he ever talk about that?
He did. He talked a lot about it. But going back to the idea that he was a systems designer from the word go. He was a patterns person. So he worked in patterns, he thought in patterns, all of his research and development, the questions he asked were pattern questions. And he could make out images, but none of it was distinct, and it didn't match the education he was receiving. So the way his mind was working and what he could see was not like any of the other children.
Why did you want to tell this story? It's a pretty extraordinary story, but talk to us more about why you were.
Well, my mentor as a child, I ended up at Harvard University when I was 10 years old, doing, you could call it an internship, at the Divinity School with Dr. Hugh Morgan Hill. I was a pretty unusual 10-year-old. Well, Dr. Hugh Morgan Hill, who's also known as Brother Blue, I encourage you to look up Brother Blue online. But his teacher was Bucky Fuller, and I'll never forget some of the times that Blue and I had plans. And he would say, well, Bucky just sent me a plane ticket, so I got to go. And I really didn't like this Bucky character, that he had the power to send plane tickets and get my man to go off somewhere. Well, I'd come to find out that he was meeting with John Denver. They were meeting with World Hunger. They were doing all these extraordinary things. It was the world game in full swing. And I was sort of a second-generation bystander to it.
You took 2 years to film this. You visited...
Oh, it's four, my friend. We got to update. We got to update the site.
Okay. How long?
It's 4 years now.
Four years now.
Yeah,
okay.
It's just we don't have the new number on there. Took longer.
And how many miles have you put in? How many countries have you visited?
Well, England twice. I also played Buckminster Fuller in a one-man show. So I did the show in London, and I did a lecture tour in London, and then did filming there. Norman Foster, for example, who did the New World Trade Center and the Gherkin in London and Beijing Airport and all the – he's a fabulous architect, and I interviewed him there. But I went to Spain, and I've crisscrossed the country by airplane, I think, four times, and now by RV, catching all the interviews that I couldn't catch any other way.
What would you say is Fuller's legacy? Then.
Trim tab. On the trailing end of a large ship is of course, you got your rudder, but on the trailing end of that rudder, you've got a smaller rudder. And the ephemeral principle of how that rudder works is we don't use a lot of effort to turn the ship. What we do is we use the energy that's already there. And Bucky used to point out that the ship had already gone by. Now we've got that little trailing edge. And once we apply the minimal amount of energy to that, it creates a low-pressure front that swings with force the entire rudder, which swings with force the entire ship. Bucky's legacy was that every human being had the capability to be an integral part of the creation of a world that would work for everyone, i.e. sustainability. And he believed that everybody's unique contribution would have integrity, it would have integrity for them, and he wanted everybody to think of themselves, or he thought of himself as a trim tab. And part of the point of my film is to point out that everybody has the power.
So people are trim tabs.
People are trim tabs. It's a metaphor, my friend.
As well.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what projects do you have beyond? I mean, this is such an extraordinary man. What projects as a filmmaker are you looking at in addition to these? What other projects have you done?
Well, I mean, I've done a number of video pieces. I was in radio and sitting in a chair similar to yours for quite a few years. Hmm. But, you know, I'm actually working on a project to play Lord Buckley. Lord Buckley in a one-man show, and I'm working with his daughter. And he was really the first rapper. He was a jazz rapper in the 1930s and 40s. And one of the reasons I want to do the project is because I've gotten something I call the Bucky wound. And the Bucky wound is when you get a little too close to Buckminster Fuller, you get a little too close to some of the people, and one of the hangover is the intellectual elitism that, and I'm just saying this to out of love, but I've met a lot of people who are trying to heal, and I'm going to get a little California on here. They're trying to heal from the fact that ultimately they feel stupid, so they've integrated themselves into the hierarchies of academia everywhere, and I think it creates separation. So I just need to do something that kind of cleans me out, and I think Lord Buckley's perfect. And then I'll probably get back. I'm giving lectures. Obviously, I was at the University of Maryland. I'm headed to Minnesota and Colorado and California, Stanford. You know, but boy, I can't take myself too seriously during all this. And believe me, I have along the way. You know, it happens when you get around Bucky.
Noel Murphy is a filmmaker whose documentary is called The Last Dymaxian, Buckminster Fuller's Dream Restored. He's here in East Lansing for a screening of the movie tonight.
I'm going to give a talk, and the screening is going to be pieces of the film because, of course, we're still editing.
Okay.
But it's going to be great, and I really encourage everybody to come.
Tonight at the MSU Library, Noel Murphy, continued success. Thank you.
5:30. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us today on Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Michigan's waterfowl hunting season is underway, and firearms deer hunting season opens in Michigan in a few weeks. Hunting's a major pastime around the state, and thousands of hunters will be fanning out in search of that big buck. Wild foods expert Hank Shaw has a new cookbook out called Duck, Duck, Goose, Recipes and Techniques for Cooking Ducks and Geese, Both Wild and Domesticated. He's also the author of Hunt, Gather, Cook, Finding the Forgotten Feast. And he runs a website for those interested in wild game dining called Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook. Hank Shaw, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get involved interested in cooking wild game in the first place?
Well, I actually started hunting precisely to get my hands on wild game. I'm one of the adult onset hunters that people talk about, where I only started about 11 years ago when I was 32. And I'd been a forager and an angler my whole life, but when I lived in Minnesota, I was in the Twin Cities, and my friend of mine taught me how to hunt, and you know, he kind of lured me in by giving me mallards and pheasants, and I wanted to cook them and eat them because I'd been a restaurant cook, and it's just an amazing produce, you know, it's amazing game that you really just want to get your hands on, and you can't buy it, so you got to go hunt it.
didn't grow up in a hunting family then?
I did not.
Okay. What was the first wild game you ever ate?
It was a mallard. It was a mallard that my friend shot on a pond in Minnesota. And it was so different from any of the ducks that I'd cooked in restaurants before that I just, it was fascinating that it could be the same animal.
Do you ever have rattlesnake?
I have, in fact, have rattlesnake.
I have as well. I was surprised at how tasty it was.
It's tricky to cook, though, because it gets a little stringy, and who knows how old that snake was. But it's not on my top 10, but yes, I've eaten them.
Your website won a James Beard Award for Best Blog of the Year. Is it a surprise to you at all that they would choose a site that focuses on wild game?
It's not as huge a surprise because I had been nominated twice before, but it sure was good to finally win one. I mean, it's you know, only three people will get nominated and go to New York, and I was the only, you know, outdoor or wild foods website that did, and to hear my name was really kind of, I was pretty stoked.
What's your favorite wild game to eat?
It's hard to say. I mean, they're all my children, right? You know, but I think if I had to be narrow, I think
I can hear. I can hear our listeners say, "Geez, he eats his children." That's rather unpleasant, but
it's sort of Greek, right? You know, like so the Titans and the Greek gods. But I would say probably ruffed grouse would be up there, and canvasback ducks would be another.
And that is just that's texture, that's taste, that's what.
It's the flavor of ruffed grouse is really pretty special. It is essentially a wild chicken, and there's lots of them actually up here in Michigan. And it's sort of the poultry king to me. And then canvasbacks are to me the kings of ducks. I mean they're fat, they're sweet, they're big and meaty. And they have such a history in the United States. I mean, this is the duck that J.P. Morgan or Andrew Carnegie would have dined on. Mm. And to be able to keep doing that tradition is kind of special.
Before you leave town, there was an article in yesterday's Free Press about woodcock and ruffed grouse in Michigan, which you should probably check out. Just in yesterday's edition, I just mentioned that it just popped into my head. Do you work up all the recipes on the website yourself, or do you take submissions from others?
They're all mine. Now that said, I adapt from some of my friends who write cookbooks. I also take some traditional recipes like Jägerschnitzel or Sauerbraten, and then I'll make them my own. So yes, it's a Sauerbraten or a Jägerschnitzel, but it's my own version of it.
Your first book, Hunt, Gather, Cook, had a focus on encouraging people to hunt and fish and forage. I'd think that most people interested in the book were already doing that. Would you say that it wound up helping people who already found enjoyment doing those things, or did you convert people for whom that sort of thing was new?
I think it's actually both. I mean, for every person, like yesterday we did an event at Red Haven, and the great thing was four people came up and said, "I started hunting because of your book," and that was incredibly gratifying. But I also heard from four or five people who were hunters who said, "I never knew about foraging before I read that book." And so it's allowed people who are already in the outdoors expand their skill set.
Talk to us about foraging.
Mm-hmm.
Just what's involved? It sounds uncommon to me. I don't know anybody who does this.
But I think you might be surprised because foraging can be as simple as picking berries when you're up at the cottage in the summertime. It can be as simple as, you know, making
asparagus.
Picking asparagus, exactly. Yeah. Or crab apple jelly or something like that. And that's sort of the core of it. And then the more and more and more that you do, like we're going to go pick hickory nuts after we're done with radio today. The wider that net, the more you depend on wild food, the kind of more hardcore a forager you are. Mm. And I'm kind of representing the edge of what you can do because I get about 20-50% of my, you know, produce from the wild.
20-50%.
Depends on the season, though, you know.
Your newest book is about cooking goose and duck. Why those two things this time around?
Two reasons, really. The biggest reason is because for the first time in maybe 20 years, 50 years, who knows, good quality domesticated birds are available to the home cook. And the reason that is because for about a decade, restaurant chefs have been excited about duck. There's so many things you can do with it. They're kind of the new pig. And so with the restaurant cooks being so excited, that's kind of come down to the home cook. And the second reason is because for every duck hunter I know, they have either a couple of recipes or two or three recipes, and I really wanted to be able to expand the ability of hunters to work with the birds that they bring home.
We're talking with wild foods expert Hank Shaw. His new cookbook is called Duck, Duck, Goose, Recipes and Techniques for Cooking Ducks and Geese, Both Wild and Domesticated. Is there a difference in how those two are prepared?
Yes. Wild birds tend to be leaner and denser because they're older and they fly for a living.
Leaner and denser.
Yes.
Okay.
Denser, like so a mallard is not very big. A mallard dressed is going to be a little less than 2 pounds, but it'll happily feed 2 people, where a domesticated Pekin duck that you would get in the supermarket is going to be closer to 3.5 to 4 pounds, and that will also only feed 2 people. So there's a density and a richness to the meat that you get in wild that you just don't get with most domestic. Now, that's changing with really good breeds, but for the most part, that's true.
Waterfowl hunting season is underway here in Michigan right now. Are there typical mistakes that hunters make when it comes to preparing a duck or a goose for the table?
It's actually a mistake everybody makes. And so here's what you have to remember. Ducks are not birds. Sounds crazy, right? But yes, they are, of course, birds biologically. But in the kitchen, they're actually beef. If you think of the breast, like steaks, and the legs and wings, like brisket, you're about 90% of the way there. I mean, remember, a duck breast should be served exactly the way you like your steak. Mm. And the legs and wings just need slow and low cooking.
Mm. Hank Shaw is the author of Duck, Duck, Goose, Recipes and Techniques for Cooking Ducks and Geese. His website, Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook, can be found at honestfood.net. Hank Shaw, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll speak with folks at the Center for Inquiry, the group behind those billboards that you may have seen that read, "Millions of Americans are living happily without religion," and we'll find out what reading certain types of literature does to the brain with the folks at MSU's Digital Humanities and Literary Cognition Lab. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is Current State's producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, as well as Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.